by VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Egypt's president has announced a two-day ceasefire proposal as the latest Israeli strikes killed dozens in Gaza and several more in southern Lebanon. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu got shouted down at a hostage memorial ceremony. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
Speaking in Cairo, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said the proposal also includes the release of some Palestinian prisoners and the delivery of humanitarian aid to the besieged Gaza Strip. The announcement came as Israeli strikes killed over 30 people in northern Gaza and at least 8 people in the southern Lebanese city of Sidon. Meanwhile, Israel's Mossad chief was travelling to Doha for talks with the Prime Minister of Qatar and the CIA chief. At a nationally broadcast ceremony for victims of Hamas's attack on southern Israel last year, protesters disrupted a speech by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. As he began to talk, people shouted, "Shame on you," and forced Netanyahu to stop his speech. Many Israelis blame Netanyahu for the failures that led to the attack and hold him responsible for not yet bringing home remaining hostages. I'm Karen Chamas.
An Israeli attack on Iran damaged facilities at a secretive military base southeast of the Iranian capital that experts in the past have linked to Tehran's one-time nuclear weapons program and at another base tied to its ballistic missile program. That's according to satellite photos analyzed Sunday by the Associated Press. Some of the damaged buildings were located at Iran's Parchin military base, where the International Atomic Energy Agency suspects Iran in the past conducted tests of high explosives that could trigger a nuclear weapon. This is VOA News. A local official says Russian forces have thwarted an attempt at another cross-border incursion from Ukraine into southwestern Russia. The governor of Bryansk said an armed group sought Sunday to breach the border between Ukraine and the Russian region, but was beaten back. The region neighbors the Kursk province, where Ukraine launched a surprise push on August 6 that remains the largest attack on Russia since World War II. The former Soviet Republic of Georgia's ruling party is claiming victory following Saturday's parliamentary elections. Opposition groups call the election rigged as polls show that most Georgians say they want closer ties to the European Union, not Moscow. VOA's Arash Arbasani has the story.
With nearly all precincts reporting, Georgian Dream appears to have secured more than 50% of the vote, cementing its grip on a nation polarized over its political future. Opposition groups cry foul. The leader of the Strong Georgia Coalition, Anna Dolidze, speaking on TV formula.
The results announced do not reflect the will of the Georgian people. These figures, obtained as a result of elections held against the backdrop of widespread intimidation, fraud, and bribery, contradict historical and current choices of the Georgian people.
European election observers questioned the conduct of the election as evidence of a democratic backslide in Georgia. If election results stand, Georgian Dream will have a parliamentary majority, potentially jeopardizing any aspirations of joining the EU. Arash Arbasani, VOA News.
Both major U.S. presidential candidates held multiple events over the weekend, the second to last weekend of campaigning before voting ends on November 5th. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump packing in campaign events for the final push to the polls. The vice president Sunday in the swing state of Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia is a very important part of our path to victory.
And she says,
I'm feeling very optimistic about the enthusiasm that is here.
The former president was in Pennsylvania Saturday night, but Trump spent Sunday veering away from swing states for a Madison Square Garden rally in New York, and both candidates were in the swing state of Michigan Saturday rallying voters.
We win Michigan, we win the whole deal, and we make America great again. You got to get out of here.
The Republican won Michigan in 2016 and lost it in 2020. The same for Pennsylvania. I'm Julie Walker.
That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
America. Welcome to the broadcast affair from the Voice of America. I'm 10:40 in Washington. Today's Monday, October 28th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump debate foreign policy with just 8 more days before the U.S. election.
Have wars? I had no wars other than ISIS, which I defeated, but that was a war that was started. We had no wars. I could stop wars with a telephone call.
We'll have analysis of what U.S. foreign policy might look like under the next president. UNICEF collaborates with the DRC government to prevent violence against women and children. Malawi opposition leader is scheduled to appear in court today, days after she was arrested. Kenya's opposition demands the release of a human rights activist arrested by police on Sunday.
These officers went early this morning to the house of Oliver Mwangi. They arrested him in the presence of his children. They did not identify themselves or say where they were taking him.
And Donald Trump's former top aide called him fascist. Trump's vice presidential candidate Vance calls the aide disgruntled former employees. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's thoughts are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vice President Kamala Harris says she believes that the U.S. should lead by building alliances to manage conflict. Former President Donald Trump says his projection of strength and unpredictability can stop wars before they begin. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wadikuswara spoke to experts on which foreign policy approach would be better at reducing conflict amid wars in the Middle East and Europe.
In January 2025, either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris will be the next American president, the key voice in determining U.S. geostrategic interests, and the commander-in-chief who will direct the world's most powerful military.
I don't have wars. I had no wars other than ISIS, which I defeated, but that was a war that was started. We had no wars. I could stop wars with a telephone call.
Trump has never explained how he will end wars. While Joe Biden was in office, Russia invaded Ukraine, and militant groups Hamas and Hezbollah attacked Israel, leading to a bloody year-long retaliatory campaign by Israeli forces. No major wars were started under Trump, and he did not get the U.S. involved in new armed conflicts. Trump supporters call it peace through strength. Democrats argue it's a coincidence and that at the end of Trump's term, U.S. troops were still fighting in Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. There's also Trump's unpredictability. Presidential historians call it the madman theory.
The idea that by pretending or at least seeming to be willing to be a madman in foreign policy, to retaliate viciously, was a way of strength, was important, and unpredictability in that sense could be a virtue.
Critics say that Trump's unpredictability paired with his self-interest is dangerous in a world with nuclear weapons. Unpredictability may also complicate conflict management.
So much of de-escalation and diplomacy depends actually on choreography, and choreography needs to be predictable. So if you know what your adversary is going to do for the next step, you can take it right up to the edge without going over.
On the diplomatic front, Harris is seen as more traditional. Like President Joe Biden, she believes in multilateralism and building alliances to maintain U.S. global leadership.
As vice president, I have confronted threats to our security, negotiated with foreign leaders, strengthened our alliances, and engaged with our brave troops overseas. As commander-in-chief, I will ensure America always has the strongest, most lethal fighting force in the world.
But Harris, like Trump, might be more selective in determining which conflicts require an American military response. The U.S. is no longer the world's single superpower.
Both Trump and Harris, you know, are not ignorant of the fact that power is redistributing in the international system, that other countries also have a say, that Russia and China, you know, have their own views on how the international order should work.
The difference, Lapson said, is that Harris believes in U.S. convening power and would be more inclined to rally countries to solve problems together. She will likely continue Biden's push for transatlantic unity to support Ukraine. On Gaza, she has emphasized upholding humanitarian laws.
Donald Trump is saying to Prime Minister Netanyahu, do what you got to do in the Middle East. Kamala Harris is saying, You have the right to defend yourself, and you need to take into account the humanitarian crisis among the Palestinians. Do either of them lead to a different outcome? Is anyone listening to the United States at the end of the day?
As Americans gear up for the election, that is a difficult question to answer, no matter who wins in November. Pat Suida Guswara, VOA News, Washington.
It is 8 more days before Americans go to the polls to elect a new president on November 5th. Republican Party candidate Donald Trump and Democratic Party candidate Kamala Harris both have varying foreign policies. Trump will pursue an America First policy, while Harris will continue building alliances. Joseph Kioko is a Kenyan political analyst. He tells me that while U.S. foreign policy is institutional, whoever wins in November will have to pay attention to China's penetration in Africa.
American foreign policy is institution-based. It is not personal. And whoever comes in, most likely there will be a continuation of the foreign policy that has been carried on by Biden. There will be no drastic change. Of course, they'll want to address the question of China's penetration and the role China is doing in Africa, being that China has one-on-one with the America in terms of support, in terms of money given to African countries, in terms of resources provided, infrastructural development in Africa. China is playing a bigger role than America would have or should have been playing. So, of course, the American interest in Africa will be looked at in relation to what China is doing in Africa. In Kenya in particular, strategic placement of America vis-a-vis China will be very critical. You remember that our President Ruto was honored and feted in America by Biden. We don't expect it to happen again, but the strategic interests that have been pursued for America in Africa and in Kenya in particular will need to be aggressive so that they can match what China is doing in Africa and in Kenya. That will be one of the key issues that they will need to pull up on.
So we have one candidate, Donald Trump. His foreign policy is going to be America First. Kamala Harris, as you said, might continue the Biden policy of international cooperation when it comes to Africa.
Yeah, of course, the inward-looking policy orientation of Trump, Make America First, we will also need to play out if Africa makes it on his table. Remember, he didn't come to Africa in his first presidency. We don't expect that to turn around. And he considers Africa three-quarters of African nation as third world and developed corrupt countries. So his opinion about Africa will not change drastically. However, in the spirit of making America great, the strategic role China is playing, he might be forced by his handlers to relook at Africa from a different perspective. Of course, Kamala's presidency will be more open. It will be more responsive to issues of internal democracy in Africa and transition politics that are happening in Africa. So Kamala will have a keener look at what is happening in Africa more than Donald Trump.
Joseph Kioko is a Kenyan political analyst. He was speaking with me from the capital, Nairobi. Former U.S. President Donald Trump, who is running for re-election, has been called a fascist and described as unfit to serve by several of his former top aides. But Trump, Vice Presidential pick J.D. Vance, on Sunday rejected the accusations. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias report.
John Kelly served as White House Chief of Staff for former President Donald Trump from 2017 to 2019. In a recent interview with the New York Times, the retired four-star Marine General was asked if Trump was a fascist and replied, quoting here, "He's certainly an authoritarian, admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure." Trump reacted to the accusations on his Truth social media platform, writing, among other things, "John Kelly is a lowlife and a bad general whose advice in the White House I no longer sought," and told him to move on. On Sunday, Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance commented on remarks by Kelly and former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, that Trump is a fascist. Vance was interviewed on NBC's Meet the Press.
People who worked most closely with him, most of them are supporting this ticket. Mark Milley and John Kelly are both disgruntled former employees.
13 former Trump aides, however, released an open letter on Friday backing John Kelly's remarks and warning the Republican presidential nominee is, quote, unfit to serve. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham strongly disagrees. He was interviewed on ABC's This Week show.
I was around him. I don't think he's a fascist. I thought he was a very strong president at a time we needed a strong president. I think he will be a strong president to get this country back on track.
Targeting battleground voters, the Democratic presidential campaign of Vice President Kamala Harris has been running an ad with audio of John Kelly's remarks. Harris herself hasn't shied away from voicing similar concerns.
Donald Trump is increasingly unhinged and unstable. And in a second term, people like John Kelly would not be there to be the guardrails against his propensities and his actions.
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who supports Harris's bid for the White House, was asked Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press whether he believes Trump is a fascist.
I don't like using those words, but clearly he has a strong, strong tendency to authoritarianism and to undermining American democracy.
The controversy comes as both presidential nominees prepare to wrap up their campaigns. Trump campaigns in battleground states later in the week after a Sunday rally at New York's Madison Square Garden. Harris is also scheduled to visit all swing states in the coming days. She will deliver a, quote, closing argument to voters near the Washington National Mall on Tuesday. Veronica Banderas Iglesias, VOA News.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, October 28th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ahead on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says it is collaborating with the Democratic Republic of Congo to prevent violence against women and children by going after perpetrators of sex crimes. UNICEF Child Protection Chief for the DRC, Ramat Touré, tells Bruce Tinodou Opoor that time is running out as fighting intensifies.
The situation of children in the DRC is a situation that is of great severity. Most of the children have experienced one form of violence, whether it's physical violence, sexual violence, psychological violence. So there is an urgent need to do something to prevent violence, but also to respond. Of course, as you know, part of the country is affected by armed conflict. So in those contexts, children are also suffering from malnutrition. They are also displaced. There are close to 7 million IDPs in eastern DRC. Most of them are women and children. And they are deprived from school. They are not going to school. So the situation is quite difficult.
Unfortunately, this problem has been going on for years in the DRC. So why now? And what do you intend to achieve by this collaboration with the government?
Why now is because during all of these years, again, actions have been done and the government also has done. They have enacted laws. And most of the international and national partners have been working to respond to violence. What we know now is like now we have a bulk of evidence on what works to prevent violence against children and also to address it. We have decades of programs of what have been working. There's also right now a global momentum to end violence against children. The DRC government and ourselves will participate next month in the first week of November in the first global ministerial conference on violence against children. We've also been working a lot with the young girls. The conference that we're having and the program that we're having puts young people at the heart of the programs, which is also quite a game changer. So right now, basically, we've had a lot of, I would say, opportunities to put all the work that's been done previously together and make it work. There's also a firm commitment from the government to place child protection and to end violence against children, and to put this as a national priority for the government under the leadership of the Prime Minister of the DRC.
That's Ramatou Touré, UNICEF Child Protection Chief for the DRC. She was speaking from Kinshasa with Bios Kinedu Opoor. There's a call for Kenyan police to unconditionally release human rights activist Boniface Mwangi, who was arrested Sunday morning. A police spokesperson confirmed Mwangi's arrest to VOA and where he is being detained, but declined to say why. Local media quote Mwangi's wife as saying that six people arrested her husband at their home. Martha Karua is the leader of the National Rainbow Coalition Kenya Party. She tells me that Mwangi should be released unconditionally because the Kenyan constitution protects citizens against arbitrary arrest.
We are saying that it is unlawful. Officers arresting someone must identify themselves. They must also inform the person being arrested of the reasons of arrest. And if they are taking him away or her, they have to stay where they are taking him. These officers went early this morning to the house of Boniface Mwangi. They arrested him in the presence of his children. There were male officers and one female officer in plain clothes. They did not identify themselves or stay where they were taking him. They just forced him to leave with them, and they were armed. So for 4 hours, people didn't know where he was. But when the matter started trending on social media, the police now admitted they had him at Kamukunji police station. As we are talking, no indication that he has been released.
We are still trying to get in touch with the police to give us the reason for Mwangi's arrest. But I'm reading that the police are saying that he's arrested because whatever he's trying to do is in violation of Kenyan law, trying to incite people to commit an offense.
Which offense? Going to attending a marathon is not an offense. And if he has committed an offense, why not then arrest him in the proper manner? Identify yourself, say where you are taking him, tell him the offense. They are now responding hours later to accuse him of incitement because of public outcry. How many other people, lesser known, who are being abducted and they disappear without trace? They have a campaign to intimidate people so that nobody can raise a contrary voice. And we are very, very unhappy.
Have you made any presentation with the police?
Unconditional release. There were lawyers and his family at the police station, and they had not released him by the evening. We even had people calling the Attorney General and the EPP to advise the police that you cannot hold people unnecessarily, and nothing has yielded.
Martha Karua is the leader of the National Rainbow Coalition Kenya Party. She was speaking with us from the capital, Nairobi. The national coordinator of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition, the HRDC, is calling for transparency and adherence to legal protocols in the arrest of Patricia Kaliati. Kaliati, the Secretary General of the opposition United Transformation Movement, the UTM Party, was arrested and detained last Thursday without charge. In their latest statement issued on Saturday, the police, the Kaliati, will appear in court on Monday, October 28. HRDC National Coordinator Calvin Cherwa tells me that Malawi's constitution protects against arbitrary detention.
Here I was calling upon the authorities to ensure that Kaliati, just like any other Malawian who is suspected of having committed a crime, is treated according to the laws that we have as a country, which include her being taken to court and probably charged or take a plea within the prescribed 48 hours that the law says or provides for. But we've seen that despite the law being there, despite the Malawi government, I mean, signing to all those international mechanisms, they haven't really respected these provisions. And as we are talking, Kariat is still in the police cell. She's there to be charged.
That is very interesting because I saw the latest police statement saying that they wish to inform the nation that the police, they are making steady
progress in investigating the case of conspiracy to commit a felony. They have had her in jail since, Thursday last week, but they haven't come up with the charges.
Yeah.
Is it usual?
No, it's very strange, actually. And we've seen this happening, I think, a number of instances where people that have opposing voices, when they start to speak, this thing happens. Actually, I think it looks like the government, not just this one, but even previous governments, they use the police to kind of silence the opposing voices. We've seen people like Kalindo, seen people like the Namiwas and others are put in the police cell. They are there, they stay over the weekend, they get out without being charged. If they are charged, maybe they're taken to court, but the cases never get to conclusion.
I saw your latest statement where I think you said a section of the Malawi Constitution guarantees the right to be promptly informed of the reasons for a person's arrest and mandates that the detainee be brought before a court within 48 hours. Do you think the police are within this mandate or they have exceeded this mandate?
As a coalition, we feel that they have exceeded their mandate. That's why actually we are pleading to them that they should ensure that the career is taken to court. That we ask that they should be taken to court on Friday itself. But knowing government and knowing the police, sometimes they have this tendency of not respecting and no more pleas from the citizens.
Kelvin Chawa, this is the coordinator for the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He was speaking with me from Blantyre. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with athletics as Ethiopia's Yomif Kijelsha broke the world half marathon record at the Medio Marathon de Valencia, Trinidad Alfonso Zurich on Sunday, clocking 57 minutes 30 seconds at the World Athletics Gold Labour Road Race. In his sixth appearance over the distance, the 27-year-old world indoor mile record holder took 1 second off the world record set by Jacob Kiplimo in Lisbon 3 years ago. The world record looked to be under threat for most of the women's race, but Agnes Ngechich eventually fell short by just 11 seconds, crossing the line in 1 hour, 3 minutes and 3 seconds, the second fastest performance in history on what was her debut at the distance. Still on athletics, Kenya's Moses Kimei won the Dublin Marathon on Sunday with Ashmirak Niger of Ethiopia, earning victory in the women's race. Kimea crossed the line in a personal best time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 46 seconds, with Ethiopia's Abebo Desaleu second in 2 hours, 9 minutes, 23 seconds. Ethiopia's Igia took the women's event in a record time of 2 hours, 24 minutes, 13 seconds, with last year's winner Sarome Ngersh her second in 2 hours, 24 minutes, 45 seconds, while Greta Dukali completed an Ethiopian 1-2-3 by finishing third in 2 hours, 28 minutes, 29 seconds. In football news, Senegal reaffirmed its dominance in Africa beach soccer by clinching the 2024 CAF Beach Soccer Africa Cup of Nations title in Hodeida, Egypt, with an emphatic 6-1 victory over Mauritania in the finals that was played on Saturday. While in women's football, Nigeria's under-17 women's national team, the Flamingos, were eliminated from the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup after a 2-0 defeat to the United States in the quarterfinals played on Saturday. The match was a rematch of the 2022 quarterfinal where Nigeria had emerged victorious. However, the U.S. team proved too strong on this occasion, scoring goals in either half to secure their place in the semifinals. Staying with football news, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, has confirmed the cancellation of the qualifying match of the Championship of African Nations, CHAN. The cancelled game was supposed to be between Ethiopia and Eritrea, scheduled for next week. According to the update from the football body, the game will not take place again after Eritrea failed to raise a home-based team for the game. Ethiopia will now advance to the next round, in which they will face the winner between Tanzania and Sudan. And now to basketball, where Women's Basketball Africa League Zone 5 qualifiers got underway on Sunday at the Amman Indoor Sports Hall in Zanzibar, with 4 matches played on the opening day. And that does it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good Monday.
And that's it for this Monday, October 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.